Welcome back to Vandenberg Flash Focus, your source for fast and focused foreign policy analysis on breaking news from around the world. This week is an exciting one for Asia watchers as Japan's prime minister travels to Washington, D.C. for a state visit and an address to a joint session of Congress. Here to break down the importance of the prime minister's visit, we have Dr. Zach Cooper from the American Enterprise Institute, where he's a senior fellow studying U.S. strategy and alliances in Asia. Zach has previously served in government on the staff of the National Security Council and in the Department of Defense. Zach, welcome to Flash Focus.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here.
So, you have a long history with studying Japan and studying America's alliances in Asia. This is obviously, a big week for the U.S.-Japan relationship with Prime Minister Kishida in Washington and speaking with President Biden and other cabinet officials and obviously speaking to Congress. I was wondering off the bat, could you give us maybe your top 2 to 3 takeaways from the prime minister's visit?
Absolutely. So, there were something like 70 announcements in the joint statement that the two countries put out. But I think the ones that should get the most attention are the ones that have lasting impact. And for me, those are really mostly in the defense security space. What I would point to are two big changes to the way the U.S. and Japan work together. So if you think about the U.S.-Japan alliance, for a very long time, it's actually often been talked about as maybe the top U.S. alliance in Asia. And now some people are even saying maybe it's the most important U.S. alliance in the world. But in the actual infrastructure of the alliance, it's lagged behind the U.S., other key U.S. alliances like NATO, right? So NATO has two things that Japan has not had. One is a combined command structure, and the second is combined capability development, so production and development of new systems. And this week, we saw the two countries move to address both of those issues. So there won't be a fully combined U.S.-Japan command. Those are going to still be separate commands, I should say, for Japan and for the United States. But what we're seeing is that the U.S. is going to establish its own joint task force that is going to focus on Japan, on the Western Pacific. And so that's a new operational arrangement. And Japan has also established its own joint operations center and headquarters. So that will address the more near-term challenge of how do we work together in a major contingency. And then they're also taking several steps to establish combined efforts to build new systems together and to maintain those systems together. So I think those are the two biggest announcements in terms of long-term impact. There's other stuff on space cooperation and economic security, and obviously a trilateral meeting with the leadership from the Philippines. But I think in terms of U.S.-Japan issues, those two are the most important.
Do you have any thoughts on, what the prime minister had to say during his address to Congress? I know he talked a lot about, from his perspective, the importance of American leadership and extorting members of Congress to make sure the United States continues to lead in the world. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that or other things he said.
Yeah, two things struck out to me. The first, exactly as you mentioned, Sam, is that he really was trying to sort of buck up the United States and say, look, you can do this. The United States doesn't need to walk away from a leadership role. Frankly, I was surprised at how directly he talked about this. But this sort of leads into the second point, which is I think there was a secondary message from Kishida here, which is that Japan is trying very hard to prepare for whoever might win the election in November. And if it's Biden, the message you heard of supporting U.S. engagement is going to play very well. No surprise there. If it's Trump, I think this was Prime Minister Kishida saying, look, Japan is maybe your top ally in the world. That's clearly the argument you've heard a bit this week. We're with you on just about everything. And so we are picking up, a lot of the slack. We are doing everything we can to help you take the burden of leadership that Trump sometimes complains of the U.S. having to, you know, do too much. And this was Kishida saying, no, you do still need to do a lot, but we're here with you. So I think this message was very politically targeted at whoever it is that's going to win the election in November.
And that's an interesting connection point to what I wanted to ask about next is, you know, Shinzo Abe, who famously got along quite well with Donald Trump. And, you know, and if Donald Trump is elected again, you know, the U.S.-Japan relationship will still be there, but he'll have a new Japanese prime minister to interact with. And so my question is, you know, most, I think, foreign policy people in Washington and most Americans are probably more familiar with Shinzo Abe than with Fumio Kishida. Obviously, Kishida was a member of Abe's cabinet and the foreign minister for many years. But is there any daylight between the two of them on foreign policy or to their approach to the relationship with the United States? Is there anything that you see has kind of changed since he's become prime minister or is likely to change with him in office?
Well, it's such a fascinating question, Sam. So part of what's amazing about Prime Minister Kishida is he's doing a lot of things that Abe tried to do but couldn't get through, which is shocking because people often thought of Kishida as sort of the quieter, less ambitious of the two. And yet he's doing things that Abe talked about doing but couldn't get done. And I think part of the reason is that very few people worry about what Kishida is going to do with new authorities and new budget. But, you know, there were concerns in Japan and outside Japan to some degree about what Abe might do if the Diet gave him more ability on the security side to, you know, take a firmer stance on a whole range of issues. So in some ways, this is like, you know, people talk about Nixon being the only one who could go to China. This is sort of Kishida being the only one that can do Abe's own reforms, right? Because he's less threatening to those domestically and internationally that might have opposed those reforms. At the same time, I think now we're entering a period where a lot of Abe's reforms are sort of done or they're underway. And the question in my mind is, what comes next? And does Kishida himself have a new agenda? And I don't think we know. You know, there's some areas, there's one area in particular where I worry that Kishida is maybe a little too hesitant, which is on nuclear weapons. So I'm not a fan of Japan getting nuclear weapons, at least not anytime soon. But I think what you heard from Prime Minister Abe before he was assassinated was a lot of talk about Japan needing to think more about nuclear weapons. And Prime Minister Kishida is from Hiroshima, and the last thing he wants to do is have a discussion about extended deterrence. But I think what is going to potentially happen in the next few years and could be accelerated if Trump wins is a lot more discussion among U.S. allies in Asia about the need to rethink their extended deterrence guarantees from the United States. And so I think that's one area where Kishida has not followed Abe, but there may be sort of a forcing function depending on what happens with the U.S. election.
So could you tell us a little bit, you know, on that subject line, we've seen a lot of changes in the Indo-Pacific security environment in the last 10 years, you know, the last 5 years in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about how Kishida and how Japan in general is approaching that role, the security role in its region, you know, obviously as an ally of the United States, but also as, you know, an East Asian country in its own, you know, in and of itself? How does it approach its security role and how does it interact with America's other allies in the Indo-Pacific? You know, there's South Korea right next door, but obviously the Philippines, Taiwan, not far, Japan or Australia, rather, so on and so forth.
Yeah, the big change I've noticed is for a very long time, you know, going back to the 1950s, the arrangement in East Asia has often been called a hub and spokes system. In other words, the U.S. was the hub and our key allies in the region are the spokes. But Japan, Korea, Japan, Australia, Philippines, Thailand, they don't connect together that much. And if they do, it's through the United States. That's sort of the historical model, very different from the way things worked in Europe. And what you're seeing now is Japan starting to change that approach. And Japan starting to say, no, we're not just a spoke in East Asia. We're increasingly going to be a hub. And so Japan is doing more with these other countries. And I think taking on more of the leadership role that Kishida talked about in his speech to the Congress. So that's probably the biggest change. And that's happening not just in East Asia, but I think it's happening to some degree globally, right? You've got Japan working with, I still find this shocking, with the United Kingdom and Italy on a fighter jet. You've got Japan working more and more through the G7 process, where it's the only Asian country that's represented. So there are big changes happening, and a lot of them are really about Japan moving from this position of being a bilateral U.S. treaty ally into a position where it's taking on more of a leadership role in its own region and outside.
And, you know, one of those relationships is also in the spotlight this week because President Marcos from the Philippines is also here in Washington, and he and Prime Minister Kishida and President Biden are all sitting down. I think it's the first trilateral meeting between the three of them. Have you been following that at all? Do you have any thoughts on what they're talking about or the Japan-Philippines security relationship? I know there's a lot going on in the South China Sea right now that affects both of them.
Yeah, I think this is an important move for two reasons. One that gets a lot of attention, which is the South China Sea, as you mentioned, right, where there's a lot of concern, as I think there should be, that China is putting so much pressure on the Philippines that we could end up in a very serious crisis around this shoal called Second Thomas Shoal. I worry a lot about that. There's also then a second issue, though, which came up a lot in the trilateral discussions, which is about how to make the Philippines-U.S. alliance more sound from a very deep political perspective, a domestic political perspective in both countries. And I think we saw a bit of the answer this week, which is that Japan and the United States and a handful of others are going to do this big investment in a corridor in the Philippines that happens to be near some of the facilities that the U.S. wants to use. So in other words, this would sort of completely reverse the trend that we saw in much of the U.S.-Philippines alliance history, which was that around major U.S. bases in the Philippines, there was, to be very candid, some bad behavior. And this is part of what led to the kicking out of American forces, right? That there was a sense that the U.S. was damaging local communities, not helping them. And what we saw this week was a series of announcements intended to demonstrate to local communities that there are going to be real economic benefits for even having a very small U.S. force presence. I think that could have an even more lasting impact than, you know, the trilateral meeting, because this is really about the long-term sustainability of the U.S.-Philippines alliance. And Japan is helping on that by working with us on some of these development efforts.
Excellent. Well, one last question. You kind of, to round it out, you kind of alluded to it earlier that people have been talking about the importance of Japan as an American ally. My last question is, do you think that Japan is America's, you know, most important ally in the world? And for those who have maybe, you know, kind of take the U.S.-Japan relationship for granted, could you just give us just a quick overview, you know, what are the key points, you know, why is this an important alliance?
Yeah, so I think I'm on record previously having said that I think the U.S.-Japan alliance is the most important bilateral alliance that the U.S. has in the world. So I'm not going to go back on that now. And maybe 5 years ago, I wrote a report with Joe Nye and Rich Armitage and a number of other folks that focus on Japan issues. And we called the U.S.-Japan alliance more important than ever. And I think you could even say that, you know, twice now, right? That what we're seeing from Japan is that it is one of the only countries that has really similar interests to the United States in a whole range of issues. So very similar security interests, right? Growing concern about China in particular, very similar economic interests, because Japan's economy, it's different from the American economy, but it has a lot of similarities. In part, you know, it's one of the biggest economies in the world. It has lots of work on innovation, et cetera, et cetera. A third issue is technology. And here again, Japan is a tech leader, as is the United States, so our interests are very aligned. And then lastly, as you heard from Prime Minister Kishida in his speech to the Congress, Japan has very similar views on global governance issues, right? And you see this through the G7 process. So this is really atypical. I mean, we have a lot of very close allies who don't have much of a tech sector, for example, and therefore don't share our interests in that area, or close allies who just aren't quite as important economically because their economies are smaller, or who prioritize different security threats, right? You know, Germany is a critical U.S. ally, but China is a very different issue for Germany than it is for Japan today. So I think part of the reason that Japan has come into the center stage of U.S. alliances is because across this whole range of issues, Japanese interests and American interests are remarkably aligned. And then finally, it's important not to forget that we have had pretty steady leadership in Japan for quite a long time. This was not always the case. When I first started looking at Japan, Japanese leaders, the joke was that, you know, they basically changed every 9 to 10 months. And so you couldn't get much of anything done. And, you know, big initiatives were impossible. I remember some of us saying that Japan should spend more than 1% of gross domestic product on defense, and that it should create an operational command and these sorts of things. And people just laughing at us because they thought it was so impossible to imagine Japan making these kinds of steps politically. So it's not just that our interests are overlapping. It's also that Japan has had some very strong, consistent leadership over the last decade plus, and that's been critical as well.
All right. Well, Zach, thanks so much for joining us and, you know, giving us a peek behind the curtain at some of the details that you're immersed in every day, you know, studying the U.S.-Japan relationship and America's alliances in Asia. Thanks for being here. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be with you.
And thank you all for listening.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Flash Focus is a production of the Vandenberg Coalition. To connect and stay up to date on our work, follow our account on X at Vandenberg Co. or visit www.vandenbergcoalition.org to learn more and subscribe to our weekly newsletter on foreign policy and national security, Beyond the Water's Edge. Until next time, I'm Samuel Byers, and this is Vandenberg Flash Focus.